Some rounds, birdies can be hard to come by. Fortunately for us all, some don't require that solid iron game to be found. Welcome to Bird Watchers, an expression of our eternal devotion to all things bird. Trade the rangefinder for a pair of binocs and keep an eye out for this week's featured bird.
Was that it? No, that wasn't that, was it?
It was close, yeah. Need to work on your whistling skills. You get put on the spot, Luke.
I get stage fright.
I feel like this was a nice, easy introductory call for you to inundate yourself with, Luke.
Yeah, thanks for the softball there.
Yeah, I decided to go easy this week. I think something like the bald eagle might have been... we weren't quite as kind to Joey, we'll say.
I'm excited to talk about birdies with you.
Oh, man, we've got some good ones. I've got a whole slate of birds lined up for us. We've been getting some recommendations in. I've had a lot of friends reach out, want to hear some different birds. But this particular one, this week's featured bird, which we'll get into in a little while, was one that's always been near and dear to my heart. It's almost like a myth in Clinton these days. We hear stories of... if you hadn't guessed it by now, the bobwhite. Bobwhite quail, or technically just the northern bobwhite. Not many of those around these days in this part of the country, but we'll get into that in a minute. Luke, tell me about some birds, man. Tell me about some birds you've seen.
Yeah. So right in line with this bird that we're featuring, the bobwhite, not too long ago, I was venturing out to the Midwest to play some golf and farm country, and was thinking of you actually, and thinking of our time down in Clinton, North Carolina, when we're at Don Butler's house, who raises pheasants and has a huge collection of really awesome pheasants, birds, yeah. Fowl.
Yeah, predominantly pheasants.
Pheasants. And was telling Clark about it, because Clark had actually brought pheasant meat to eat on the trip. Nice. We were camping and cooking the whole time, and he had done some hunting before meeting up with me and picking me up in Illinois. And we were talking about that. And I kid you not 2 minutes later, after we're talking about pheasants, we're driving down this country road. And out of the brush, there's like high fescue grass, native grass lining the road or highway. And like 20 feet in front of our car, pop out of the brush, two birds with red, like reflective coloring, some darker undertones. And I was like, oh my gosh, that's literally quail or pheasant or some, you know, some sort of fowl that must have been listening to our thoughts and just popped up out of nowhere. It was pretty awesome.
It's funny how that seems to happen when, you know, it's like manifest destiny. You think birds into existence. It's, birds are everywhere, man. If you want to see them, all you've got to do is usually pick your head up. In the case of the quail, usually it's actually looked down, but sounded like to me, based on your description, like what you had seen were probably molting pheasants out of season. They dropped their tail feathers. You said they were roughly chicken-sized, maybe a little smaller. That's all I've got to go on. I'm guessing they were pheasants, especially in the part of country that you were in. Fun fact, I think a lot of people probably don't know this, but there are no species of pheasant that are native to North America. So I think a lot of our homies in the Midwest are probably super familiar with ringnecks, which are about the only species you encounter in the wild, but they're an introduced species. That dates back to the 1600s, 1700s, with people bringing them across as a game bird. It's kind of an alternative to chickens. They just were a bird that they could get their hands on. They're obviously gorgeous. I mean, ringneck pheasants are like a really, really spectacular bird, even as far as pheasants go. They're one of my favorites to look at, for sure. But yeah, they're not a native species, contrary to what a lot of people might think. There's a fun fact on, not our featured bird, but one we'll probably be highlighting soon, I'm sure.
Yeah.
Definitely going to get into some pheasants at some point.
Well, and like you were saying, birds popping up out of nowhere when you're starting to look for them. We are very fortunate here in our office and shop space to have tons of birds always flying around and hopping around. We've got some holly and tons of fruit on the ground around, and a lot of trees this morning I heard, I think it was a blue jay. But yeah, you start to become aware of birds making noises and you start searching for them and you get rewarded with seeing some really cool, profiles and species.
100%. And then having the luxury of being able to watch the same habitat day in, day out, right out the office window, you'll learn more and more about what birds are making what calls. I mean, that's where a lot of my knowledge comes from, is just repetitive observation, being able to, for it be in my backyard or the same golf course every day, knowing, seeing the same birds day in, day out, and then slowly being able to pick out their calls, one from each other. Blue jays actually like to imitate other birds. You'll hear blue jays imitating hawks.
And that's the noise I heard first. I heard a noise that was like an osprey or some sort of hawk. And that's when I immediately snapped my head over and I saw the blue. And then I heard the blue jay call like 10 seconds later.
There you go.
So I don't know, yeah, if it was two birds or just one. But
we did see, Matt and I and Skylar had a hawk encounter outside of the office, I guess 2 weeks ago. There was a Cooper's hawk flying, I mean, in the brush right outside. I don't know what he was after, but he was super close. You saw a flash of this bird fly by. So, of course, I rushed outside, peeked my head around a bunch of places and saw him. He had flown to a nearby tree. But, yeah, I mean, we're in the heart of Raleigh, and there's still all kinds of crazy bird activity going on. Everywhere you go,
yeah,
the birds were sure to follow.
And speaking of hawks, back to that trip out to the Midwest, with all that rolling farmland, I can't tell you how many hawks I saw just posted up on fence posts, just staring at fields, waiting for some sort of prey to pop its head up.
Oh, yeah, probably a lot of kestrels. Those are just one of my favorite. And hawks, like, yeah, all kinds. That's their favorite place to be, and that's the best place to look for them. Fence posts, power lines, looking out over big open fields. Yeah, there's not much like that. I always, I've made friends grab hold of the steering wheel before so I can stop and look and tell them what kind of hawk we just rode by. yeah, that's my favorite kind of bird watching.
It's become a really area of your expertise to explore, and it's definitely gotten us all on the birdie bug, the bird watching bug. Excited to sit down and talk to you today about birdies and the Bob White. Speaking of which, you, I heard, had some birdies the other day to go on to have a pretty nice round at Tobacco Road.
This past Wednesday, went out to visit our friends at Tobacco Road with an old friend of mine, Festus. So I think I've mentioned before, he was the first golfer that I knew, first person who really introduced me to the sport. And we played Mid Pines on Tuesday, my first trip there, and I shot 86, not worth talking about. I did make a birdie. I don't even remember which hole. But that was the highest round of the year, probably the worst golf I've played all year. Wake up, we stayed at the Pinecrest, go out the next morning, 9 o'clock, play with a twosome, father and son, who were great. My second trip out to Tobacco Road following Home on the Range back in June. But that made me the only person in the group who had played the course, and followed my worst round of the year with the lowest round of my life.
It's funny how it all works
It's
out
so
that
funny. 74, bogey start, and then played the rest of the way really well. Birdie 3, 8, and 12. No doubles, which is always a goal. And then got up and down from about 50 yards short of the green on 18 in one of the waste bunkers. Hit the best shot of the day and probably made the best putt of the day to... And I knew what that was for. So that's, you know, I think part of golf for me that's always been great is the personal challenge of it. Every time I tee it up, I'm trying to shoot even par, because I never have. I'm always happy to break 80, but I'm always trying to shoot a personal best. Like, that's always the goal, is shoot the lowest round you've ever shot today. And so standing on the green at 18, I've got a 7 or 8 foot putt that breaks about 2 cups, knowing that it was for my low round. And to make that putt, you know, that was... That's one of those moments that, yeah, you'll always remember, especially to do it at Tobacco Road of all places, to go out to that course and, yeah, shoot that number. So, yeah, 74 is the lowest number I've ever written on a card. So, pretty cool. 3 birds. We encountered, I don't really remember seeing any memorable birds on the trip. We came across, there were definitely some hawks flying. We saw a lot of vultures. Nothing up close, though, or nothing super memorable in terms of the birds, but the birdies make up for that. We like to see those, too.
Right on.
They're always nice. Everybody in the group made one, at least. Everybody played pretty well, too, so that makes it for a good day, for sure.
drawing circles is always a good thing.
Yeah, get the protractor out. Good trip. Definitely some birds. That's definitely going to bring me back there soon. I'm just itching to go back and play that place again for sure. Now I'll always have Tobacco Road's a special place, and that's going to be a cool special memory to have of that place for the rest of my life for sure. Hopefully it won't be the lowest I ever go, but for now I can say that it is.
Will anyone be getting that scorecard as a thank you note in their Lion Loft order? Are you keeping that one?
That one is in the collection. It was actually, it's interesting. That was Mid Pines made course number 30 of my career. I was going back and counting, and Mid Pines was the 30th golf course that I've played. I keep scorecards from every place I've ever played. And anytime I shoot a low round to replace an old scorecard with, say, Lonnie Pool, I've got my 75 card and Lonnie Pool and then Kahari, yada, yada. Yeah, that one's went straight to the top of the pile.
Hold on to that one.
100%. Luke, let's get into it. This week's featured bird, the Northern Bobwhite.
Much better than mine.
named such for that distinctive call, the Bobwhite. It's where they get their name. Northern Bobwhites are probably the most prevalent, or at least the most common game bird in North America. Game birds, typically we just think of dove, pheasant, quail. Those are the three. But Northern Bobwhites are one of the six species of quail that inhabit North America. And I believe there are around 23 subspecies of bobwhite. Subspecies, again, like most birds, that's denoted just basically based on geography. You can find bobwhites everywhere from Central to Midwest, North America, all the way up to Canada, all the way down to Mexico, and more heavily so, at least traditionally, on the East Coast or the further east you go, closer to the Mississippi. But I wanted to highlight the bobwhite today. As I mentioned before, there in my part of the world, in Sampson County, North Carolina, bobwhites have become almost a myth. They get spoke of in the same sentence as the good old days. You know, I can say, I don't know how many times I've heard, back in my day, you know, we could just walk around the farm and you'd see covey of quail everywhere. Covey being our collective term for a group of quail, like skein for geese. Joey had a lot of fun with that one. Quail populations have been on the, not even steady, a pretty rapid decline since the 60s. I've seen that it's estimated that anywhere from 80 to 85% of bobwhite populations nationwide have declined since 1960. And we attribute a lot of that due to, one, like most creatures, habitat degradation, the use of pesticides and its corrosive properties on eggs, not to mention the creation of infertility. It has a huge effect on the fertility of populations, which in turn affects the fertility of eggs. We don't really attribute the hunting practices, at least not in the modern day, to this decline. Many places where you go to hunt quail, these populations are in controlled, fenced-in areas. One thing about quail is that they don't migrate. They're not a migratory bird, and thus they tend to live actually in really small areas. This is why we have so many different subspecies, because over time, as they've kind of spread out and been distributed, they haven't gone and mixed in with other species. They tend to stay in these same locales where they, you know, over time have evolved their own unique little characteristics, distinct features, colorations, things of that nature. More or less, if I put all 23 subspecies in front of you, it'd be hard to tell the differences between them just from the naked eye. A lot of these places to hunt, because this is always one of the questions when people come to about quail or pheasant or whatever, geese, whatever the point may be, how can people both be supportive of the bird populations and want to see more quail and also support hunting? And a lot of places are actually hunting preserves or preserving the land that quail need, and they fence off some of this land, and they can basically captive raise birds in a large area, you know, a 1,000-acre pen or so, several hundred-acre pen. But they can control the population. These are basically pen-raised birds, and then the wild populations are kept separate from these captive birds.
What is their ideal habitat?
So quail are ground-nesting, ground-dwelling birds. They would live their entire lives on the ground if it was up to them. They only fly in short bursts and only when spooked or only when it's necessary, over very short distances. That's why they're actually pretty hard to spot in the wild unless you're in an area where there are a lot of them. And if there's one quail, you're going to see dozens of quail. They group in these coveys. They can be as large as 30 to 35 in a single group that is nesting, sleeping together. fun fact, they sleep in a big circle with all of the birds facing outward from each other, which is just a really cool, neat thing to picture, and is a pretty unique characteristic among birds.
Is that a defensive move?
100%. Yeah. It's I mean, that's
it's
what...
It's like in the movie 300.
Yeah, I'm imagining the quail with their little loops on top of their head and little swords and little shields. They yeah, it's 100% just as an alert type thing. But they like low shrubby areas. They're seed eaters, mostly seed eaters. They're omnivorous, like a lot of birds. They'll eat small insects, things of that nature. But they really like seeds, corns, grains. And so fields like wheat fields, like you were describing out in the Midwest, places like that, where they have a lot of food, they have a lot of place to forage, and also they have a lot of cover, where because they're ground dwelling, they don't like large open spaces because they're super visible and super vulnerable to predation. Again, they're pretty chubby little birds, not the most agile in the air. They make for easy prey for raptors, raccoons, fox, any of those things of that nature. So definitely you're going to find them in very dense vegetation or wheat fields. Be on the lookout when you're in these fields for them. If chances are, if there are quail around, you'll know it. That call of theirs is very loud, especially for such a small bird. And very distinctive. I can guarantee everywhere you go in the country, people know what that call is. In parts of the world, my research getting ready for this podcast today, I found that the population of quail really depends on the specific locale that you're in. Quail are really, bobwhites are really, really sensitive to environmental and ecological change. And those changes can really have dramatic effects, even in the space of a week or a month. Pesticide use, things of that nature can have an instant impact on quail populations. That being because quail bobwhites, I keep referring to them, I need to be scientific here. Northern bobwhites are, they can lay as many as 5 or 6 clutches of eggs in a single breeding season. Breeding season being typical, you know, early spring into midsummer. They can lay up to 5-6 clutches of eggs, but if, say, fertility rates are really down that year because of maybe heavier than normal pesticide use or maybe an earlier harvesting of crops that year, things like that, they might not lay any clutches that year. And so populations, even not even from state to state or region to region, but even from field to field, can be really, really impacted by these things. And so populations are hard to monitor on a year-to-year basis. It's hard to have a good idea of their overall, the health of the ecology or the ecology of bobwhites in your area, which is why it's really important that the land and pesticide use, land use is tightly managed, because even one mistake or even one farmer, for instance, can have a really big impact on the overall health of this bird population.
And something to note too is these birds, the bobwhite, has been around for, they found fossils that are over 2.5 million years old.
Incredibly old birds.
That is wild.
There aren't many modern bird species that have direct roots that old. I know we talked about the loon and we've talked about flamingos, and those are really, really old birds. But yeah, that's something you don't find a lot, particularly in North America. And these birds are specific, you know, but they have relatives across the pond. Old world quail, which we were learning a little bit leading up to this, which I knew actually little about. But they're their own unique genus. And yeah, they've literally got their fossils here. They're fascinating and like super important. They form a vital ecological role, not only in, they're at the bottom of the food chain. So in that way, they form a vital role. We got to keep our hawks fed, got to keep our raccoons fed. And of course, people love hunting them. People love to eat quail. Bobwhites, and they're just neat. They're really cool, cool birds to see. And that's where for me, I discuss them being a myth. Anytime I've only come across bobwhites 2 or 3 times in the wild. I know once near Kinston at a friend's farm, and that was like startling to me to see them run across the little 4-wheeler path. And I was like, whoa, like I've never actually seen bobwhites. I've heard them. I've heard stories about them and how prevalent, but to actually come across them, yeah, they're a little bigger than I'd always imagined. They're still small, just little fat things, man. And they're just, to see them just scurrying across the ground and refusing to get up and fly, it just makes them, yeah, they're just unique in that way.
One thing I saw that I thought was interesting, the males are widely different in their coloring, but the females are pretty much the same. So there's a lot, there, what, 22, 21 to 23?
Yeah, like 23, I think, subspecies.
Subspecies, and the females all look kind of the same, but the males are what vary. And I thought that was interesting.
And even across the major, we have like, what, six different families of quail in North America. And yeah, the males, you know, from California quail, the mountain quail, they all, yeah, the males have really bright, different types of bright coloration. And the females pretty much are all identical.
Is that another protection thing where, like, I know with cardinals, right, the male cardinals are bright and red and the female cardinals are brown and a little smaller. But as a kid, I don't know why this has stuck with me as a fact, or the reason why is so that a mating purposes with males attracting female. And then also I heard, I guess, that cardinals would fly away to draw off predators and they'd be like a bright color, whereas the female could kind of blend in. I don't know if that was true.
It's one of those things where the coloration is almost entirely, at least traditionally, attributed to mating purposes and drawing, and the fact that males will breed with multiple females, and females usually only have one breeding partner a year. They lay one clutch in most species of birds. With bobwhites, we assume the same thing, that is for breeding purposes. In terms of males trying to lead away predators, I can't speak to that. I'm not sure.
We might need to fact check that.
I can say that, yeah, that's really common for, if we look at a close relative, because actually, old world quail are apparently in the pheasantae family, so closely related to pheasants. I never knew that. And then going to digging in, they're Franklins and partridge, which kind of makes sense. They closely resemble. But that's a really common thing in the bird world, where a lot of females from different species will actually closely resemble each other. Like, say, in waterfowl, you know, like mallard hens and black duck hens and pintail hens, other than maybe the shapes of their bodies, their coloration is actually like super similar. And you go to pheasants, the same thing, you know, if we, all the different species of firebacks, the females are almost indistinguishable from each other. And then you can do the same for different species of tragopans, where the females are super close, even across species, even though the males look entirely different from each other. And that's like, to me, that points, and this is me speaking off cuff, but to me, that points more towards just females needing to be more drab because they spend more time on the nest, or they spend more time, they're smaller, they're an easier target. And so those colorations and those patterns are just because, like, no matter where you go, those are the types of colors that they need to survive. Whereas males are less concerned with that kind of thing because they're males and they're, you know, oh, I'll take them on, you know. So it is an interesting pattern, and it's interesting you notice that as well, that, you know, across species, the females all look alike. You can't tell them apart from species to species. Mm-hmm. And I think the more and more you look into birds, the more and more you'll see that to be the case. Man, yeah, nice one, Luke. Do you have any more questions about the bobwhites, or any more things you'd like to point out about them?
So they talk about the bobwhite being a New World quail, correct?
Yes.
So what is a New World quail compared to an Old World quail, and where did quails originate? Like, are they a North American bird, or did they come? I know pheasants originated
Southeast Asia, mostly.
Southeast Asia, yeah. So is quail something that originated here in North America?
So we do attribute, so New World quail are an indigenous species. That is to say that as far back as we can date, like you've pointed to fossil records, they've been in North America. And they are an entirely different genus than Old World quail. That is to say that they're not actually super closely related. Even though they have a lot of similar characteristics, they look alike. You know, the different species of Old World quail, a lot of them look very similar to some of our species of New World, albeit with some different distinctive characteristics. Like, for instance, California quail have that distinctive little loop. What was the old cartoon we think of? Quail Boy. And maybe Recess?
Well, yeah.
Was it Doug? Recess? Doug, yeah. Doug and the Quail Boy. You know, you think of the belt tied around his head, like that little thing. Like, that's a really distinctive New World quail feature. And Old World quail, again, based on what I was reading a minute ago, or like more closely related to like Franklin's and partridge. Like at Don's, he has these rurus, like wood partridges or crested partridges. And so there is no fossil record, to my knowledge, that indicates that there, that we know when, we have to assume that old world quail were original and that they're probably an older species, or an older genus. And that somewhere down the line, those two, you know, have a common ancestor. But as far as when and how those became divergent, we don't really know. Again, not to my knowledge. To answer your question, I don't know.
More research needed.
Yeah, more research needed for sure. It piqued my interest learning more about these different species and seeing that old world quail are actually in the Pheasantae genus, whereas new world quail are in their own genus by themselves. And there's six species that occupy that genus. So as far as taxonomy goes, they're two distinctive things. I think maybe at some point we'll do some old world quail and we can dive more, we'll do some more research and dive into old world quail and what makes them so unique.
Sounds like a plan to me.
Man, yeah, the more birds, the better.
Well, I enjoyed learning more about the northern bobwhite and also enjoyed listening about your career low round.
Oh, yeah, I enjoy talking about both, as anybody who knows me will attest. Before we go, as always, I'd like to point our listeners to an organization that's near and dear to my heart and that does a lot to help not only bobwhite populations and conservancy nationwide, but also for all birds, that being the American Bird Conservancy. Habitat loss is the most heavy contributor to declining bird populations globally, and particularly in North America. And each year, there are millions of acres of suitable habitat that are lost or degraded. And that puts the future of countless different species of birds in danger of extinction. And the American Bird Conservancy is an organization that looks to partner with other land conservancy agencies to find mutual benefit from the conservation of land and the conservation of bird species. One of the cooler groups around because of this interdisciplinary approach and the way in which they approach conservancy. And I would highly encourage our listeners to go check them out at theamericanbirdconservancy.org. Check out their website. Please consider donating, and please consider ways in which you can, in whatever way you occupy the world, you seek to positively impact species of birds. The birds need us as much as we need them, and I think it's important for all of us to make sure that we're doing our parts to educate, to raise awareness, to raise money, and we can save the birds.
More birdies, the better.
More birdies, the better. And so until next time, I wish everyone a lot of bird sightings, a lot of birdies made, and until then,
caw-caw! Caw-caw! Thank you.